Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Hey there, Tech Stuff listeners. This is Jonathan Strickland, and I've got a request for all of you. Now, Chris and I have decided that we're going to try an experiment. We're doing our first crowdsourced episode of Tech Stuff, and we want to know what your pick is for the worst video game of all time. Now, nominations, you can make one nomination. You nominate one game and you need to tell us the name of the game and the platform it was on. And it could be any platform. It could be an arcade game. It could be a PC, Mac, Xbox, PS3, Nintendo, handheld console. It can be web-based if you like. But just you let us know what the platform is so we can make sure we count that as the votes. So you can nominate your game either through email, which is techstuff@howstuffworks.com, or you can nominate through Twitter or Facebook. And we're going to put a cutoff date on this. I want to have the episode go up by the end of September of 2011. So let's say you need to get your nominations in by September 8th, 2011. So if you get those nominations into us, we will make sure we include those in the process, and we will have an episode where we give you the worst video games of all time based upon the votes of our listeners. Thanks a lot. Can't wait to hear from you.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I am an editor at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me, as he frequently does, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
I'm the dandy highwayman who you're too scared to mention. I spend my cash on looking flash and grabbing your attention.
Okay.
I told you, I giggled when I thought of that, too.
Yeah, okay.
Sometimes when I come up with the quotes that I use at the beginning of podcasts, it's immediately before we start recording, like today. And I started cackling as soon as I thought of which one I wanted to do. Anyway, today we're going to talk about digital theft, but we're really going to focus on a specific case here. And it's an interesting one. Chris, you want to set this up?
Yeah. Well, where to start? I guess we should just start specifically with the details.
Yeah, yeah.
There is a, I guess it's probably best to call him an activist.
Yes.
Named Aaron Swartz, who was arrested in Boston a few days before we were recording this, in early August of 2011. And he's been accused of taking 4 million digital documents, essentially, from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and JSTOR, which is an online digital repository of scholarly journal articles.
Yes, journal storage is essentially what JSTOR stands for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, anybody who's listening who is either in college now or – you know, recently, probably in the last 10 or so years, probably is familiar with JSTOR, especially in the humanities and related things. But yeah, so he's been basically charged with essentially sneaking into a closet on the MIT campus, hooking up a computer with a removable drive to the network equipment, and downloading millions of documents.
Yeah,
and the federal government has charges out against him.
Yeah, the federal government, the United States federal government, alleges that Swartz's intent was to distribute these files in distribution manner, usually peer-to-peer network, like the Pirate Bay, something like that, right?
Right.
That's the allegation, although everything I read up till the recording of this podcast suggests that there's not really any actual publicly known evidence to support this, that it's really just an allegation that's based upon Swartz's history and the fact that he actually got these 4 million documents. Here's some interesting things about this case that are a little odd to me, just on the surface level. So you've got Swartz, who has apparently broken into MIT in order to download these documents, leaving the computer there because, of course, we're talking about millions of files, so this is taking a while to happen. He was working over at Harvard. Harvard also has access to JSTOR documents. JSTOR documents, if you don't know, colleges will pay some sort of subscription fee in order to access different parts of JSTOR's database.
Yeah, I can get into that in lots more detail if you want to.
Sure, because that's an important part of this discussion, actually. I mean, to really understand this case, and I don't even say that I fully understand it, but you need to get all the details to really kind of get a grip on what this means.
Yeah, that's the funny thing to me about this particular case, because a lot of times people who are breaking into and stealing electronic files from people, I think of them as going after the big targets, people who basically are specifically involved in copyright fights, people like the movie industry or the recording industry, where they're saying, I'm doing this because the industry is repressing, you know, as making this information unavailable to the public. Mm-hmm. JSTOR, on the other hand, is a nonprofit.
Yes.
JSTOR, as you mentioned, is short for Journal Storage, and it was actually founded as a way to make journal articles available online, digitized, and then made available to institutions. At one point, there were only a handful of journals available and a handful of colleges and universities that subscribed to them. But over time, it's grown amazingly, to be honest. The thing is, with JSTOR, they do collect fees from all these institutions, partially for equipment, partially to help fund institutions that have a tougher time with the fees. And they have to negotiate, a big part of that too is the licenses, that they have to negotiate with publishers because, JSTOR is not, the publisher of a lot of these documents. And not everything, of course, is owned by someone. The copyright is only valid for some of the stuff. Some of the other stuff is older and not in the not under copyright anymore. So the thing is, though, that the publishers may have different requirements for being published in JSTOR. Like some publishers have absolutely no qualms about making a journal article or an issue of a journal available on JSTOR immediately after it's been published. So it goes to press and then it ends up on the shelf at the library And at the same time, you can access it digitally. But others might require an embargo of 6 months to a year. So you may, you know, they may expect you to go to the library and actually pick it up. Now, part of the benefit to these databases is that it makes it available more widely, especially for distance learning students. But it also helps mitigate the cost somewhat of subscribing to some of these journals, which can be very, very expensive, and sometimes in the case of thousands of dollars. Because, you know, these magazines are not like, you know, Time or, you know, Rolling Stone or something like that, where they're subsidized by advertising. It's that, you know, these are scholarly journals, and they have a much smaller readership, so they have to charge a lot more to keep them in print. And this using these databases can make it a little easier. It also frees up space on the library shelves, so that's you know, another benefit to doing that. But yeah, JSTOR is essentially, though, a nonprofit, but and makes it available through grant funding from the Mellon Foundation and other sources. So I still find it odd that he would target a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to this specific purpose, rather than somebody else that seems like it would be a more obvious target if you were going after people who were enforcing copyright.
Right, and to make this even more complicated, JSTOR, you know, when we're talking about these fees that mostly libraries and universities pay in order to get access to some of these libraries that JSTOR has available, that money is not really going toward JSTOR. That money is going to pay off the licensing fees JSTOR has to pay to these publishers in order to get access to these documents in the first place. So, you know, you can't really vilify JSTOR too much. It's not like it's a for-profit corporation. It's a non-for-profit. So it's not, you know, they're trying to provide a service. So in a way, they're caught in the middle in this. But another complicated issue is that more than half of the documents that Swartz was grabbing were in the public domain, in the sense that copyright had expired on these. They were either old enough so that they were no longer under copyright, or otherwise they were not protected by copyright. They were public domain articles. So you've got the argument from some people who say, if it's in the public domain, it should be publicly accessible.
Right.
There should not be a wall between the consumer and the content.
Yeah.
Because it's public domain. It's no one owns the copyright to that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's that too makes sense that he would use that as a target. My counter argument would be that JSTOR probably keeps that behind the wall because they need people to provide funding for hardware and for salaries, the people who work with the product.
And yes, I do. Broadband costs as well.
And broadband costs too.
Yeah, there are real operational costs to operating JSTOR. It's not like, you know, we can easily forget that there are real costs associated with anything digital, right? I mean, it's easy for us to forget. I mean, you sit there and say, all right, sure, yeah, there's electricity costs because you got to pay to power the servers. But then you think, well, then you got to actually buy the servers. And you don't just buy the servers. You have to maintain the servers and buy backups so that if a server fails, another one immediately goes online. And these needs keep on going. And the money, there is real money that you have to spend to do that. So, but there also may be some agreements with the publishers that they're licensing things with. Why that might be a reason why things are behind a paywall too, is not because the content itself is under copyright, but because it's part of an overall agreement with an actual publisher saying, oh, well, sure, we will license this stuff to you. But part of that agreement is that you have to keep all this stuff behind a walled garden as well. Now, when it comes to stuff in the public domain, we can also make the argument of just because it's in the public domain doesn't mean that you can just waltz up and grab a copy with no consequences. For example, an example I saw quoted in a great article was about, Shakespeare's works. All right, well, Shakespeare's works are in the public domain.
Yes.
You know, he did not renew that copyright. It was very short-sighted of him. And so, but that doesn't mean that you could walk into a bookstore. I was going to say Borders, but
not anymore.
So long. Parting is such sweet sorrow. But you could walk into a bookstore. You can't walk into a bookstore, lift up a copy of Shakespeare's works and say, "This is in public domain," and then run out of the store with no fear of being brought up on shoplifting charges. That's not the way it works.
Right. And likewise, you might say, well, there's a copy available at my local public library and I can go read it for free. And that's true.
Yep.
Well, that may be. The copy at your public library may have been lost. No, I'm kidding. But the thing is, though, that's not free either, because taxpayers are footing the bill for keeping the library open, for building the collection, for paying the librarians and the other people who work in the library to be there and make that available. And for buying a new copy when somebody wears it out or spills grape juice all over it.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm not saying that it's necessarily right to keep an item that is in the public domain behind a paywall, but there are reasons why you might charge to make it available because there are costs associated with it. So I see an argument for either side, because I think public domain, information should be, free and available, but, there are logistical things too,
But now you could also make the argument that, let's say that you've got a bunch of material that is no longer protected under copyright,
mm-hmm.
and you go ahead and you get hold of that. There's nothing that stops you from distributing that content.
That's right.
You can distribute it as much as you want once you have it. Like, mm-hmm. It might get a little tricky. You might have to make a copy of it in such a way that if someone else has added something to that, like, let's say, again, you take a copy of the complete works of Shakespeare and there are annotations and notes in there. That makes it more complicated. But let's say that you were to, by hand,
mm-hmm.
copy every single one of Shakespeare's plays, and then you decide to make as many copies of that and distribute it to as many people as you want. That's perfectly fine.
Yeah.
So there's some people who are asking, well, was Swartz trying to do the equivalent of that? Was he trying to get hold of material that is in the public domain and thus put it up for people to share as widely as they want because it's in public domain? So therefore where's the law being broken?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't, if there's no copyright there. See, this is where it's getting complicated.
Right.
And to be honest, not all these questions are even, we're not capable of answering them because we're not lawyers, but more importantly, there's not a lot of law around this kind of issue. A lot of the laws that Swartz has been brought up on, or charges that have been brought against him have to do with wiretapping and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I was going to go through those really quickly here.
Sure.
The charges, right now, that I've read about, from the U.S. attorneys include, computer fraud, wire fraud, obtaining information from a protected computer, and criminal forfeiture. And he does face up to 35 years in prison and 3 years of supervised release, if he is convicted. So yeah, I mean, this is no laughing matter.
No.
But these issues are why it's, well, I think it's why the copyright holders, the people like the RIAA and the MPAA, are so afraid. Because it's not clear. I think, honestly, I think they probably would enjoy being able to make their stuff available to people in different formats. But they're scared that people can just make one copy and run off with it and nobody gets paid. And that, it's a somewhat legitimate concern. But
yeah.
But in this case, it's different. But I do think that's a lot of why. I mean, the laws are vague. They, these technologies haven't been around for a long time. And, governments are not exactly known for their speedy reaction time on trying to resolve these issues. And especially now that new technologies are available and are changing the way we do business, it's just muddying the water that much further. And so it's going to be interesting to see how this case comes out, because it may set precedents for how we handle a lot of these copyright issues online.
Sure. And really, a lot of the problems that come up around this center around the fact that we're talking about digital products, which are they lack something that real products, quote unquote, real or analog products have.
Yeah.
Scarcity.
Yeah, that's true.
There's no such thing as scarcity in a digital world.
That's true. And there's also a lack of substance to them as well.
Well, so there's a lack of substance in most of the things I buy.
There is no physical manifestation.
Yeah, there's
of
no form factor there.
The document, which adds to the fact that you can make as many copies of this as you want to and distribute it as in the matter of seconds around the world.
Yeah.
So it makes it very difficult to create laws that both protect the person who created it and
the consumer
and the consumer both and give them both rights, you know, the producer to get paid and the other person to access that content on a fair basis.
So for those of you listening who don't have a grip on the scarcity issue, I'm sure most of you do, but just in case, if we're talking about physical products, let's say that Chris is, what do you want to have? Let's just pick a physical thing that you want to have as a product that you are offering. I was going to assign one to you, but I'm going to give you the option of choosing one.
Well, are we talking about something that I would do now?
No, anything. Like anything. Pie in the sky. If you want to say unicorns, you can say unicorns.
No, I want to say unicorns.
Okay, so Chris is offering, he's got 10 unicorns for sale.
Okay.
And I really want one of those unicorns, but I don't want to, you know, pay for one because I'm a nefarious ne'er-do-well, as quoted at the beginning of the show. And so
it's pretty accurate.
I've decided that I am going to take one of those unicorns, and I take one of the unicorns, and now Chris has 9 unicorns.
No, you cannot has.
So Chris has 9 unicorns, and he's out one unicorn with no amount of money that he was going to ask for said unicorn. So I have stolen it.
Do you know how hard it is to breed unicorns these days?
I imagine it's going to be very difficult because I hardly see them anywhere. But I see the meat on over at Think Geek. they sell the canned unicorn meat there. So I've decided to take a tasty unicorn, and I did not pay for it, so I have stolen it. And that it's easy to see that, right? Because there's evidence there. Chris had 10 unicorns. Now he has 9 unicorns. He has no extra money. This is something that is easy for us to make laws about. I mean, granted, not about unicorns, but, you know, stealing in general. It's easy to make laws that cover this sort of thing because it's a concrete example that I have taken something from someone else without giving them what they were asking. And so easy to see.
Yeah, because you can actually see it. It's in his backyard.
Yeah. And we're talking like this is an ancient concept. I mean, we have every single major civilization that ever existed had some sort of law protecting people against theft.
And that goes back to the very founding of the United States. Of course, we're not the only people in the world to have copyright. Copyright actually predated the formation of the United States by, I would guess, I can't remember the last time I read this, but I think about 2 or 3 centuries, maybe somewhere in there. I mean, not thousands of years.
Right.
But in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, the Congress shall have power, and it goes into all these different powers, to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. That's really vague, but it assigned a basic copyright.
Yeah.
It gave you the opportunity to make something and get something for it.
And this is where it gets a little more complicated, because now we're talking about ideas. And ideas are not like unicorns.
No, they're not.
I wish I had picked something different now. Ideas are not like physical products that actually have a true, like, there's a physical representation of them, and they are not, you know, you can't just clone a physical product over and over and over again at no cost.
Well, actually, you know what? My original choice until you said unicorns was a Gutenberg Bible.
So
there are very, very few. Well, no, there are very, very few of them.
Right.
And we can't also reproduce it.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so you would not be able to produce a new Gutenberg Bible.
Which no, not an,
a new
an actual
Gutenberg Bible would really freak me out.
Oh man, I'm not doing well with this.
No,
today.
It's okay.
But I mean, yeah, something. Well, a Bible in this case is older than that. But yeah, say you had a rare book that was published, and there are maybe 20 of them left in the world.
Right.
And it's the first edition of this book that was printed 150, 200 years ago or something like
that. So at any rate, the theft of that is obvious. Now let's talk about a digital version of that. Now, a digital version of that same book, you don't steal the original. You make a copy.
Right.
So the original is still exactly where it was. So Chris still has, if he had the 10 unicorns, that's what it was, right? Let's say now you've got 10 virtual unicorns.
Okay.
10 files that are called Unicorn 1, Unicorn 2, Unicorn 3, etc.
Okay, sure.
And I have gone and I'm like, I want one of those unicorns, those digital unicorns. And I go and I make a copy of Unicorn 1. Well, from Chris's perspective, he hasn't lost anything physically. He still has those 10 files.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
So it's different from the traditional route of theft, defining what theft is and being able to punish theft. Now it's still, I have managed to take something from Chris without giving him anything in return, but it, you know, you can't, defining the punishment, defining the crime, you can't use the old model to really fit the new crime, right? I mean, it doesn't encompass the same thing. So that's where we're at right now. We're at this point in our history where we have not yet truly defined what these crimes are, what they encompass, how they should be punished. We keep trying to use these old models that don't really fit the new model of the way things work. That's where we're starting to fall into a lot of these issues. And people like Swartz have been pointing this out for years.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not the only one. Lawrence Lessig, of course, a professor at Harvard, has been talking about issues with intellectual property and copyright laws and copyright law reform for years. And in fact, Lessig and Swartz have a history of working together on different projects, like the Creative Commons Project.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these are really smart people who are pointing out we can't continue to try and force new ways of thinking into old models because it's just not going to work. We have to come up with a new way of dealing with these approaches. Because that's the way the world's going. It doesn't matter if you like it or if you don't like it. If you think things should be, if you think the information should be free or if you think it shouldn't be free. And by free, we're talking about freely accessible, not necessarily, you know, not that there's no cost associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you say information wants to be free, do you mean that information wants to be out there in the world, or do you mean information wants to cost no money? I think most people would argue the first rather than the second. So in other words, as long as a company is able to make stuff available to consumers in an easy way, an easy, timely, inexpensive way, then consumers are pretty much happy to go and flock to it. If they are not willing to do that, then consumers will then turn to piracy.
Yes.
So there was an interesting discussion I read about how this balance between free and paid and this balance between intellectual property and public domain. And part of the argument was going that we have companies that will promote something. Let's say it's a video game.
Okay.
So they'll pour a whole bunch of money into promotion and months and months and months of promotion, which ratchets up the anticipation of the people who are the customers, right? They want to play this game. And as that anticipation ratchets up and up and up, and the game has yet to come out, those people are more likely to turn toward piracy because they have this anticipation they want to satisfy. They want to have the experience of playing this game, but they have not, they don't have a legitimate pathway to get there. So they take the illegitimate pathway.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, it's not that it's the fault necessarily of the content creator, but they are somewhat enabling this culture of piracy. So in order to take that out, you need to think of a new way of approaching your products. Perhaps you don't promote your product months and months and months ahead of time and build up this anticipation. Perhaps you create an early build and you charge a very small amount for it. You make it easily available and you at least are able to profit on that anticipation early on. The solutions have not all presented themselves, but the point is that taking the old way of doing things is just not going to work because the world is changing.
Mm-hmm.
So whether you want information to be free or not is not the point. Information is going to be free.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you know, I should point out, I feel compelled to point out that that Swartz is actually is also affiliated with a nonprofit himself to achieve what he, you know, sees as some attempts to make information more freely available. And this organization is called Demand Progress. They basically have said that they are interested in finding ways to change public policy that they see is choking the internet, making the internet difficult to use, I guess.
Yeah.
Or difficult to get information that you need on the internet. Let's say that. And one of those issues, according to the CNET article I read, was the Protect IP Act, which in the United States,
yeah.
It is basically designed to help block access to websites that are suspected of piracy.
International websites,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, not just the United States, but internationally.
Actually, I think almost exclusively internationally.
Hmm.
But which is kind of interesting because you're like, how do you then enforce something mm-hmm. that is on international websites? Although the argument could be made, you do it by limiting where sites from within the U.S. can link out to that, including things like search engines.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, the FBI has actually also investigated him previously too, according to Boing Boing. Again, this was quoted in that CNET article that I read, but they basically have been looking at him for trying to get U.S. court records from the Public Access to Court Electronic Records database. This was back in 2009. So yeah, I mean, they probably had their eye on him, and it may play a mitigating factor in what's going on. I mean, if they believe that he is a threat, they will probably make sure that they send him a message.
Yeah, yeah. There, I did read that one potential motive for the federal government was that, you know, they were essentially trying They were still angry over the 2008 Pacer issue. That was the whole. Well, Swartz ended up participating in a call for downloading documents from a government database of court records, which you were talking about there, Chris, and he did it really, really well. And it was because there was this brief moment where these documents were free, when normally they would cost about 8 cents per page. And so Swartz ended up downloading, I think, like, around 20 million of them. So 20 million documents that were free at that point that normally cost 8 cents per page. He got hold of the 20 million of those. The government got a little upset about that, but Swartz did not break any laws. He was following the law. The law said that at that point they were free and that anyone could download as many as they wanted. It's sort of like if you open up a buffet restaurant and someone comes in and sits down and they start going to the buffet table and they go to the buffet table like 15, 20 times and you think, well, you know, you should really go. And like, well, I haven't had all I can eat yet.
Yeah.
It says all you can eat, and I have not eaten my fill. You have been here 4 hours.
I also feel compelled to point out that that my note program just crashed. But Swartz is not the only person to have acted on these principles.
Sure.
I had been reading too about Gregory Maxwell in an article on Ars Technica, who posted 32 gigabytes with 18,592 scientific articles to BitTorrent, and basically said that Swartz's arrest was what decided, or what he used as inspiration for posting this. And he said, there's a quote from him: "All too often, journals, galleries, and museums are becoming not disseminators of knowledge, as their lofty mission statements suggest, but censors of knowledge, because censoring is the one thing they do better than the internet does." It's possible too that other people will act on similar principles and decide to do that themselves. This is definitely something that's not going to go away
No, and this is a very, as we've said, this is a very complicated issue. You've got a lot of different parties involved here. You've got the actual people who are creating the content. You've got the people curating the content. You've got the consumers of the content. You've got the government in there. I mean, this is one of those things that's going to take some real legislation to kind of address. And even then, you know that at least one of the parties is not going to be very happy about whatever the outcome is. And so it'll be interesting to see how this story develops as it moves on. It's again, it ties into things like we've talked about the ethics of piracy before and whether piracy is ethical or not. You can argue that, well, if you want to be able to get content that's in the public domain out so that people can actually see it, is there anything wrong with that? And, that's a tough question to answer, You could argue that maybe for anything that's in public domain, there should be at least an easy way to access it.
Yeah.
If not, if not like just distributed everywhere, wherever it does reside, it should be pretty easy to get to.
Yeah.
But we just haven't created those systems yet. And in the process, it's pretty ugly. Well, that about wraps up this discussion on lots of interesting topics: intellectual property, digital theft. Now, where are we going from here? And honestly, we just don't know until more time has passed.
Yeah, it's funny. We often have a solution or something or an idea of how we would proceed with this, but this is thorny.
Yeah, and it's a complicated issue. And it's and you know what? It'll probably be a really tumultuous issue for a while, and we'll get to a resolution, but I bet it's going to be a rocky road. So,
rocky road.
On that note, we're going to wrap this up. If you guys have any suggestions you would like us to tackle in a future episode of Tech Stuff, let us know. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle there is Tech Stuff, HSW. Or you can send us an email, and that address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com. And Chris and I will talk to you again really soon.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join How Stuff Works staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow. The How Stuff Works iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.